Hello, Carrie Gracie here, and thanks for downloading the interview from the BBC. My guest today is Jetsun Khandro Rinpoche. She is a Tibetan Buddhist leader and a woman, and if that didn't make her unusual enough, she's also venerated as the reincarnation of a Buddhist master who lived a century ago. Jetsun Khandro Rinpoche, welcome to the interview.
Thank you.
How does it feel to be a reincarnation?
I don't personally feel any sort of different. I don't really entertain that question in the first place very much. Basically, all human beings are born and are reincarnate, but recognized reincarnations are sort of the great masters is a tradition that is quite prevalent. So I was recognized at quite a young age. I was about 10 months old, and I grew up, and people always refer to you as a reincarnate of a teacher. But personally, I've never felt any difference.
And yet, what was it about you that marked you out? I mean, you may take it for granted, but others don't. There must have been something special. I know when the Dalai Lama was found, there were rainbows over his farmhouse. What about you? Were there portents? What was it?
Well, I think I'll have to go by what people have told me happened. Apparently, when the previous Khandro Rinpoche was dying, she had told her students where she would be born, and it happened to be. So she had said she was going to be born in a place in the northeast of India, and given the name of the monastery, so I was born there, and then they recognized me at that time. So one hears those kind of things. I myself don't tend to recall any extraordinary event.
And do you recall in your childhood people telling you that your behavior was or was not appropriate to that of a holy master?
I grew up a very naughty girl. And I grew up at a time when most of the Tibetans had, it was the sort of second generation in exile after the invasion of Tibet, and many Tibetans left the country. They were all living as refugees. But this was the first generation where they were also experimenting with sending children to Christian schools, convents, or different other Indian schools. And so it was kind of an interesting time where young children were seeing things beyond monasteries. I was sent to normal schools, and certain times, of course, the older monks and the nuns would, I think, quite be afraid that we would take on, let's say, certain habits that were not really good or conducive to being a Buddhist teacher.
And you are Khandro Rinpoche. You are referred to as Your Eminence, and Khandro is obviously the name that you inherit from the Buddhist master,
yes,
of whom you are the reincarnation. But mm-hmm. Was there ever a matter of choice for you? I mean, you describe being at least given the opportunity to see another kind of way of life, but were you ever given the choice to take another way of life?
If you are recognized as a reincarnate teacher, child very much does not get much of a choice unless parents decide otherwise. You know, no one can force. But there isn't much choice given to the tulku or to the child itself. In my case, it was a little bit different because women tulkus are a little bit unique that in that sense that there aren't many. So I think they took it as an exception where they allowed me to have a lot of freedom to make my own choices.
And the Dalai Lama, I know, he's talked about choosing the next Dalai by popular vote. Now, that's an interesting idea. Do you think that would reduce reincarnation to the level of politics and remove some of the mystique, or is it quite a good idea?
I think times change, and Buddhist teachings have always really emphasized the need for changing according to the needs of times. There used to be a time when reincarnations and their recognitions were very, very important. But if you speak to most of the Buddhist teachers, especially someone like His Holiness, he will not put much emphasis on recognitions. Recognition of rebirth of a great teacher is very fine, but you must have the qualities.
Just on the qualities, let's stick with that for a moment, because of course your daily duty is to evolve those qualities in yourself. You are a practicing nun. What is that like? Describe an average day.
Well, I think the common, very fundamental theme would be is availability to the others. If in whatever way that you are able to live is enabling you to respond to the others, I think that would be a good day. So, of course, in the monastic environment that we live in, there are very strict, rigorous schedules of, waking up very early in the morning. There are always the two main community prayers, which begins early in the morning, and then you conclude the day with also the community prayers, which is very similar to any traditional monastic environment. And then in between, of course, there are all the teachings that you do, and then you meet with people, and you also go to the office and go through the daily administration of the monasteries and the nunneries or different organizations that you have.
Do you feel a sense of enlightenment all the time, or do you have to work at it?
Oh, I don't think we feel enlightened, or I don't at least feel enlightened at any time, actually. Not all the time, but any time. You just do your best.
You don't feel enlightened at any time. That's disappointing.
No.
I thought that after a lifetime of working at it, you'd have at least got somewhere along the path.
No, I don't think so. I think everyone, no matter what title you have, no matter what name you have, everyone starts from point one.
Now, I know your religious community is based in India, but you do travel the world teaching, and you're speaking to us today down the line from Paris. And as you walk through Paris, looking at the faces around you, looking through those shop windows full of elegant clothes and high-heeled shoes, do you think these people have got it all wrong?
No, I think they're very beautiful. I think they're very beautiful. I don't necessarily find them something I would need, but I don't think that I reject them. I think every individual has different tastes.
So you're not tempted to go and try those on. That's not the temptation to
No,
which
no.
you're
I chose
vulnerable.
to become a nun at quite a later age. I was 19 years old. I went to a regular school. I went to a Catholic convent. I went through all of the normalcies of life, and it was my choice to become a nun. So, on my own personal front, I've never felt any sense of, that I've brought in any kind of great sacrifice by being a nun.
Are there experiences in life which you regret missing out on as a result of making that choice at the age of 19?
Any regrets that I've had that I've not been able to do?
Yeah, like for example, having children, being a mother, because you live a celibate life, as I understand it.
Yes, I don't think so. I don't think so. I actually look after a lot of young children, and I have my own adopted children, so I don't find motherhood as a thing that I miss.
Now, getting back to the actual religious aspect of it all, prayer, teaching, mindfulness, is Buddhism actually a religion? I mean, you don't have, as I understand it, a god figure. You don't believe in an immortal soul. You don't have priests.
I don't think so. I have tried to work through this question because I teach a lot in the West, and sometimes people sort of benefit a lot by referring to Buddhism as a religious belief. And I think if it's helpful to them, inspiring to them, Buddhism, from its own standpoint, has no difficulties in being referred to as a religion or not. But essentially, if you look at what the teachings is, it really is not a religion as a systemized religion is. But definitely, it requires a person to really work with one's own self. So I think it's almost being able to engage fully as a human being. A common phrase everyone uses these days is that it teaches a way of life. And I think that's very suitable, actually. It does teach a human being its true way of life.
And when you say it teaches a human being his true way of life, of course, Buddhism doesn't have one key book, and the Buddha himself was careful not to talk too much and seemed, as far as I can make out, to refuse answering questions that he thought unhelpful. So why have so many of his followers written hundreds of books over the 2,400 years since his death? Why have they invented so many characters? Why have they instituted so many rituals? Why has Buddhism become so much more complex than the Buddha himself made it?
That's very good, actually. That's what I really think also is that Buddhism, as it was founded and as it was taught the very basic simplicity of being able to recognize who you are as a human being without letting any of your own false, you know, assumptions of it impede the way. That's what Buddha taught. And you have to trust that. You have to trust your own basic fundamental nature and allow that to be not contaminated by suppositions of what might be or what it might not be. But I think once the Buddha himself left, then I think human doubts and human emotions and human hesitations just are very rampant. And we come up with all sorts of excuses and doubts and hesitations why not to trust our basic nature. And I think the subsequent enormous amount of work, written work and teachings, are just answers to refute the human doubts and ignorances that simply doesn't allow oneself to trust one's fundamental true nature.
So do they all need to be put on a big bonfire, some of these works, and burned?
Not necessarily. I think if you have, as long as you have questions, why not to trust your own basic nature, you'll always find the number of teachings as answers or as antidotes very helpful.
And yet the Buddha, as we've said, did not spend a lifetime reading or indeed writing books. Is there a danger of elitism, of jargon, of getting stuck into doctrinal disputes and neglecting what he posed as the more fundamental challenge of liberating the mind?
I think so. I think to a certain degree you're very right. And it has happened. I think in the last 2600s of Buddhist history, there have been elitists. There have also been a lot of solidification of a religious philosophy rather than understanding the true intention of the Buddha when he gave the teachings. But that's always going to happen. I think human nature is always going to try and bring all sorts of interpretations to what they might assume to be correct. I feel it's absolutely important that one never deviates from the essential point of being honest.
And so for those who have not been brought up in a Buddhist tradition, who may have to grapple with the religiosity of whatever tradition they belong to, just remind us, remove all the layers that have built up over the past 2,500 years, and remind us what was remarkable about the Buddha himself and what he taught.
You know, one of the most remarkable things about the Buddha is he didn't see anything that we don't see every day of our lives. We just don't challenge what we see as the Buddha himself challenged. If you look back at the history, you just find Buddha struck by birth, old age, sickness and death, and then filled with enormous wish to see and find a way out of birth, old age, sickness and death, the sufferings. But we see birth, old age, sickness and death all the time. But it never occurs to our mind, maybe perhaps I should do something out of the box, I should think something out of the box, that maybe there is something more to a human life than to just be drowned in one's own habits and habitual patterns. So I think the remarkable sort of the quality that you see in the Buddha is that he did not take things unchallenged. He questioned. And his questioning mind led him to finding answers. We don't do that. We're very happy simply following patterns. We never think anything beyond our own capacity to realize that there may be a potential far more better or far more able than to simply do the same things again and again our whole life.
And when you say that to the other sects of Tibetan Buddhism,
from, I think we would
use the schools. Do they take your point, or do they say, no, but it says in my book here, or look at paragraph 59, section, clause, da-da-da-da, this is what it's all about?
No, I don't think Buddhism has gotten to that point where we are stuck with a certain dogma and unable to actually go back to the words of the Buddha. We may forget, and we often sort of look at ourselves and see, oh, yes, we are forgetting about this. But it hasn't come to a point of degeneration where people would have, I think, diluted the entire teachings to that degree.
Now, I just want to remind anyone joining us that you're listening to the interview on the BBC World Service. I'm Carrie Gracie, and my guest today is a Tibetan Buddhist leader, Jetsun Khandro Rinpoche. Rinpoche, have you studied other religions? I mean, you mentioned that you spent time in a convent. Have you studied a lot of other faiths?
Well, I think one of the good circumstances of being born a refugee is you really are exposed to other countries and other cultures. I grew up in India where Hinduism is very strong. I grew up in North India where there are a lot of Muslims, and I had a lot of friends who are Muslims. And I did spend a number of years going to a Catholic convent school.
And do you see Buddhism as simply an alternative to Hinduism or Islam or Christianity or Judaism, or is it in some way the only true way of life?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. I think as a Buddhist, we begin to see that what we are trying to understand from the Buddhist teachings is not the truth of Buddhism, but rather truth to human nature, whatever is true to human nature. The term Buddhism that we use these days is a very new term. This word itself didn't exist about 50 years ago. I think it just happened when a lot of the West began to sort of ask, what is this philosophy? And a name had to be given. So I think it came up with, just as we say, Judaism or Hinduism. Similarly, I think Buddhism is a newly coined word. Before that, I think the word that we use is just Dharma, which simply means the truth. And so whatever is the truth, and that truth can come and be practiced in different ways in other philosophies, Hinduism, or even in other Christian or Muslim, different kinds of philosophies.
And do you get frustrated then with a tendency from the West to have to categorize, to name the parts? I mean, is it possible then to be just a relaxed kind of Buddhist, Christian, Muslim in some kind of eclectic way?
Well, I think I find that very interesting. I think I remember coming to the West very in the late 80s, and many people who were very curious about the teachings of Buddhism often would tell us to, you know, really give us just what Buddhism is and not to give us the culture of Tibet. And that also another thing that they would point out is that West, especially those who were curious about Buddhism, were inclined to being very non-theistic. And so I thought that was marvelous, that there was a group of people who didn't want to become theistic. They didn't want the culture. They wanted the truth as it is. But over the years, what I have found is this is the same common habit, whether East or West, is we human beings have an exceptional gift of giving a name and then being attached to a name. And so here it is. We start off our journey wanting to find the truth, and then we suddenly end up in the middle of the way being very proud of the truth as I see it.
So we get stuck in a kind of isolated ghetto which places us in a them and us mentality.
Yeah, we do get stuck. That's yes, very unfortunately.
And do we, for the same kinds of reasons, need to escape from a sense of ancestral religions, the kind of tribal religion that we were born with? Do we need to study them all and freely choose our truths?
I think so. I believe anything that is inspiring to the people, I think is very good. So if it's heaven, or if it's enlightenment, or if it's wisdom, or happiness, as long as it's a motivation that inspires you to get going into acquiring good qualities, into abandoning what are harmful and negative causes to your own self as well as to the others, I think that's good. And that also is together with, you know, sort of tulkus or reincarnate lamas or ancestral religion or ancestral lineages. If they tend to, in the beginning, inspire you, you're fascinated with that concept, and if it inspires you, I think as far as inspiring you and getting things started, that's very useful. But the problem starts is when you begin to solidify it and you begin to find that to be the it.
Hmm. So are there disagreements, even in the world of Buddhist nuns?
Disagreements about?
About things like this. Do you end up arguing with people?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Does it get heated?
I think, but the good thing is these disagreements are all taken as, you know, fine. That's the very fundamental teaching of the Buddha, is there are no right answers other than what is that you find to be true. One can say what is not true by seeing its falsity, but eventually no one can posit the truth. Truth has to be a personal experience.
Mm. And the talking about the ancestral faiths, we've touched on the history of Tibet and the political and religious situation of Tibet. Let's confront it directly for a moment, because, of course, Tibetan Buddhism is without its leaders in Tibet itself right now. And your family fled to India, as you explained, with the Dalai Lama in 1959 as communist China's religious persecution took hold. You were born outside Tibet. You've lived outside Tibet. You've never been back. Explain to us in greater detail why that is.
Well, I think that's the very, I think, harder sort of experiences of our lives is that you call yourself a Tibetan and you're very much part of the country. But those of us who are born in exile has never been able to actually return back to one's country. So I think that's always a challenge. That's always a challenge. But at the same time, I think you have to have a much more vast perspective in knowing that since His Holiness especially is outside of Tibet and very much within us and among us, I think it's always much more inspiring, and one doesn't tend to get sort of engulfed in the sense of loss of one's own country as much. I think things would be very different if His Holiness were not among us.
So being a Tibetan is an idea, in effect, is part of the life of the spirit.
Yes, yes.
And through that, it doesn't feel so despairingly like an exile.
I don't think so. And I think to a certain degree, the practices of Buddhist teachings probably has done a great deal in being able to work through that situation. I sometimes observe, look at people who are in a similar kind of situation, and sort of the grief and the resentment seems to be so very strong. The Tibetans by nature have been a little bit jovial, not necessarily the very happy kind, but still quite relaxed and not so resentful or not so much in grief. And I think that's a lot to do with their view of Buddhist teachings and integrating that in their life, which has enabled them to, I think, hold on to some amount of joyfulness despite the difficult circumstances.
And yet, just over a year ago, we saw those riots in and around Tibet surrounding the 49th anniversary. Do you pay close attention to what is happening inside Tibet, and how then do you feel about it?
Certainly we do. I think as part of things happening within your own country, you do tend to have a much more deeper interest into it. And, you know, I think the example of His Holiness in being able to see and hope for a peaceful resolution, I think that's very strong among most Tibetans. Of course, I think it's human nature for oftentimes people to just become very frustrated with it, and it's been a number of decades. And so it's sort of frustrating for many people, and in their frustration, not everyone can practice absolute patience. And therefore, I think that does
and
come
out. And also, sorry to interrupt. Yes, and sorry to interrupt you, but as a political message, some would say the Buddhist idea of nonviolence has got Tibetans nowhere, that sometimes a bit of grief and resentment concentrates the mind.
I have thought about that. I have thought about that. But I think I must answer that question from two perspectives. If I look at it from a person who has not much understanding of Buddhism as just a citizen of Tibet, I would definitely say to some degree that, you know, nonviolence hasn't gotten us much anywhere. But I don't know. Every time I think about it in that way, immediately there's a part of me which actually then says, you know, you're fine where you are too in so many ways, which doesn't mean that you don't aspire to go back to your country or to see your country free. But the impact that would occur in the mind isn't as much. I find, you know, you are where you are and your home is where you are. And people are kind around you. You have the freedom to practice. You have freedom of speech. And basically all things are good. So a sense of, I think, complete loss and isolation tends not to be so bad within our own selves. And you have to be very practical in that approach, is that violence or doing anything other than what His Holiness has so far very successfully maintained, I don't think would get us any better than what is happening currently.
It's quite a hard message, though, isn't it? Are you basically saying that if Tibetan Buddhism dies out in its homeland, that is a price that will have to be borne, and that if Tibetan culture...
I think if you look at the half-empty glass, I think that is how you would look at it. And on the other hand, if you just looked at, had Buddhism not left Tibet, I don't think so many people would have had the benefits of having the path of practice of meditation. So there are always adverse circumstances, sometimes are your best friends.
A hard lesson.
Not so sweet, but that's how it is.
And do you think you will get to Tibet in your lifetime?
Oh, yes. Of that, I'm absolutely sure.
Why?
Well, for one, it's not very difficult to go in. It depends, you know, if you're going to say, are you going to go into a free Tibet? I would say that's something to be seen in the future. But the question, if it is about going back to Tibet, even practically, it's not so difficult. And yes, certainly, I think it is where the growth of all of our practices and teachings, as well as our family, comes from. And on a very, very, very realistic notion is that most of our monasteries and most of the root monasteries are all based in Tibet, and it will make absolute sense and needful to go there.
Now, you denied earlier on that you had achieved any degree of enlightenment, but you do seem, through the course of this conversation, to be very serene about many things. And I'm just wondering if that is a product of a life of prayer and meditation.
I think I've always thought, you know, if you have wonderful teachers like the teachers we've had, and their kindness in giving us the teachings and trying to make us understand, I think anyone can do it.
So you don't let things irritate you? I mean, for example, right now, do you have a little still voice saying, this interview is asking very stupid and impertinent questions, but it's all ephemeral, just let it pass?
No, I think, no, not at all. I wouldn't ever think anything was happening that was meaningless. Everybody who does anything does it out of the best intent.
So you don't allow yourself to feel irritation with other people?
Well, I do get irritated, but I don't think I necessarily let the irritation be something because it isn't pleasing to me.
In your book, this is something that puzzles me, you describe the possible hells we might end up in after death. Crushing hell, crying hell, the hell of ceaseless torment, the hell of burning blisters, the hell of clenched teeth.
Yes, there are 18 kinds.
How do you know there are 18 kinds?
No, not necessarily. 18 is just a number that is given in the text as possibilities of trying to find classifications. And depending upon how creative your mind is, you can create probably one general hell, or you can create tremendous millions of numbers of different kinds of hells. That's up to you.
And yet, if I was to interpret these different hells in a literal way, say I step out of this studio in 5 minutes' time and I commit a murder, does that mean I will endure a hell right now in my guilt and my sense of sin? Or when I die, is my next rebirth going to be in some hell of torment?
It can be either both, or it can be any third option, as, you know, not happening now, not happening next life, but happening over a course of many lifetimes.
And so it's quite a detailed map of suffering that is drawn out in these teachings. I mean, let's just take an example. Those Parisian clothes and shoes and the people wearing them that we mentioned earlier, is there a hell specifically for the trivial, for the vain?
You know, human beings living in this world, some of their experiences are no less than hell. I wouldn't call it trivial hell, but definitely it is the gift of being a born as a human being in this human world, but the circumstances being so full of suffering, it is a good mixture of both, of being human living in a hell realm.
And are you afraid of the life that comes hereafter, or do you see it as yet another opportunity, a new gift?
I don't think there's reason to be afraid of the next birth. If you think what you're doing in this life has not been a cause of harm or suffering to the others, you can always be sure that the next life will not be so bad.
And yet, the way that you set it out suggests that if each and every individual now followed the way, the Buddhist way, they could escape this suffering,
right,
or to a degree, they could be in a process of escape of suffering and in a process of a better rebirth in this life or in the next life. In which case, why aren't you on a missionary drive to insist that every individual you meet follows the way?
I think human beings, I don't think Buddhism has ever taken on a sort of a course of the sort of being a missionary or trying to enforce one's philosophy on the others. I don't think that's ever been the way of the Buddhists. I think natural curiosity has to be a human being's own individual, so I think the word I would use here is awakening. Unless you are able to come up with your own motivation, it will be very difficult. Even if someone were to tell you Buddhism is very good or Buddhism is very helpful to you, the complacency of one's own ignorance and inability to really see the drowning that we are sort of being submerged within our own hesitations, I don't think will enable a kind of certainty of appreciation of the Buddhist teachings.
And do you think it's possible, as you peer forward into the next life, that you might be reborn a Muslim in Saudi Arabia, a Christian in Bible Belt America, a Jew in Israel? Is it possible for somebody who has followed the way to be reborn in an entirely different ancestral faith?
I think so. I think if you look at the causes and conditions, and if you were to look at different causes that you would create that would lead you to a certain kind of a birth, yes, it's not necessary that anyone who has studied Buddhism is only necessarily by virtue of that connection born into a Buddhist family.
Would that in and of itself be a worse birth for you?
Worse rebirth? I don't think so. Any circumstances, you know, you can be born a monk, a nun, you could be a recognized teacher, you could be sitting on a high throne, and you would have the most selfish, greedy life, and that would be a very bad birth. Comparatively, being born as anyone, even as an animal, but that which would give a source of happiness to the others is a better birth.
Jetsun Khandro Rinpoche, thank you so much for joining us on the interview.
Thank you very, very much.
For details of our complete range of podcasts and our terms of use, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcast.